In Ukraine, an attack that has caused far more damage than it would initially seem. It was a familiar tactic when a dam was targeted.
Russia has repeatedly targeted natural resources or especially critical infrastructure in a number of wars.
Also ahead, for U.S.-bound migrants, the walk across the Mexican desert can be deadly. A small group began recreating the walk 2 decades ago to call attention to the danger.
I did not think we would be walking 20 years. We just thought people would figure it out, and we thought something will change, right?
I'm Carol Hills. Plus, a film from Sudan makes it to Cannes. Goodbye, Julia follows the story of two women during South Sudan's split from Sudan.
I felt the responsibility to document this period of time for generations to come.
It's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. More evidence is coming out that that dam breach in Ukraine was no accident. A research group in Norway says seismic readings from the area in southern Ukraine are consistent with an explosion. Ukraine continues to blame Russia for blowing up the dam from the inside. Moscow is denying responsibility and says Ukrainian shelling could have done the damage. Outside intelligence agencies have not been able to confirm who did it. What is clear is this. The destruction of the Kakhovka Dam has displaced thousands of people and caused cascading ecological disasters. You could even say that water has become a weapon of war in Ukraine. Again. Erica Weinthal is an environmental social scientist at Duke University. Erica, let's start with a scene setter. What is the history of this dam? When was it built?
The dam was built in the mid-1950s. It was part of an era of large infrastructure construction throughout the Soviet Union. So the Kakhovka Dam was part of a large hydroelectric power plant that was built to provide hydropower, water for agriculture, especially irrigation systems, and for drinking water.
What's been the strategic importance of the dam over time?
The dam, like many other large dams and reservoir systems, serves multiple purposes. It provides water for drinking water, agriculture, but also this dam is located at the front lines of the current war in Ukraine as a result of Russia's invasion.
What is Russia's history of using natural resources like water as a weapon?
Russia has repeatedly targeted natural resources or especially critical infrastructure in a number of wars over the last few decades. One could go back to the two wars in Chechnya, the first in 1994 to 1996, and then the second war from 1999 to 2000. The Russian military carried out multiple strikes on critical infrastructure that both displaced people, but also destroyed power plants, cut off the water supply to Grozny, the capital city in Chechnya. It also was involved in the Syrian war, where it carried out also airstrikes on critical infrastructure, particularly, you know, attacking water systems, energy infrastructure, beginning in 2015 when Russia entered the war to support the Assad regime. Russia has been an occupying power in Ukraine since 2014, and their water has repeatedly come under fire, where the population in eastern Ukraine has not had access to water for over a decade. At periodic times, it's been completely cut off to clean water. So Russia has carried out a policy that is often referred to as scorched earth policy.
Now, Russia is hardly alone in using nature and natural resources as a weapon of war. What other historic examples can you describe?
Over the last decade, there have been multiple conflicts in the Middle East, multiple civil wars. Here, we've seen the intensification of the targeting of civilian infrastructure, in which different warring parties have sought to either capture dams. There was a lot of attention paid to the Mosul Dam in Iraq, whether it would be taken over or not. There have been attacks on electrical power plants. There have been attacks on irrigation systems. Agricultural fields have been set on fire. The environment has really become the new fighting ground in many of these conflicts over the last few decades.
Is destroying a dam a violation of international law?
Yes, without a doubt. Dams and other critical infrastructure are to be protected under international law, under the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions explicitly state that dams, dikes, and nuclear electrical generating systems should not be objects of attacks.
But does that have any teeth? It's not clear yet who destroyed the Kakhovka Dam, but if it is determined, what happens to the entity who did it?
At the end of the day, the destruction of the dam is a clear violation of international law. Any form of attacks on civilian objects, critical infrastructure, the environment should have some form of accountability. So when Iraq set the oil fields on fire in Kuwait, at the end of the war, there was a process set up in which Iraq was then held accountable and had to pay reparations to Kuwait. It is unclear what forms of accountability will take place when this war ultimately ends, but there will be a need for mechanisms for accountability.
And Iraq set those fires. That was in the early 90s in the first Gulf War.
Correct. And here, the challenge within the war in Ukraine, Russia's occupation of Ukraine, is that Russia is a member of the UN Security Council. So it is much harder to hold a member of the UN Security Council accountable.
Beyond flooding, what are the other human consequences of destroying a dam, whether in Ukraine or elsewhere?
Most importantly, this has led to the displacement of large numbers of people, but it is also, it really highlights that these are no longer invisible costs of war. So when we often talk about the destruction of the environment or infrastructure, we don't really know the immediate costs. And here, the invisible costs of war are becoming so visible because we are seeing oil slicks showing up on satellite imagery. We are seeing people losing access to their water. We are seeing potential loss of agricultural land, crops being destroyed, flooding of industrial sites where you could have chemical contamination of ecosystems, harm to fishing stocks where people will not be able to eat fish from the river. So there are multiple harms that will come from the breach of this dam.
Erica Weinthal is an expert on environmental politics at Duke University. Erica, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me today.
A Russian-speaking cybercrime group is claiming responsibility for a huge operation this week. The hack targeted employees of British Airways, the BBC, and residents of Nova Scotia. The hackers issued an ultimatum: negotiate a ransom and pay up, or the hacked data will be released across the internet. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Nobody wants to hear that their personal data has been stolen by Russian hackers, particularly if you're working as a journalist covering the war in Ukraine.
We have many members who work in really challenging environments, whether that's in Russia, whether that's covering events in Iran.
Michelle Stanistreet is with the National Union of Journalists, which represents many BBC employees. Earlier this week, the Broadcasting Corporation told all of its staff in Britain that their personal data may have been stolen in the hack. And Stanistreet says journalists, especially those reporting on international news, are worried about protecting their sources and their families. The criminal gang thought to be behind this data breach is known as CLOP.
They've successfully infiltrated more than 256 organizations and have made claims to received more than $500 million in ransom.
Rob McLeod has been following the gang's movements for a number of years. He's with cybersecurity firm eCentire, based in Canada. The hackers targeted a piece of business software called MoveIt. It's used by thousands of companies worldwide to transfer large files. The BBC outsourced payroll to a company called Zealous in the UK that uses the MoveIt software. And McLeod says that probably made the broadcaster vulnerable.
If you were to do your payroll processing in-house, you're not going to make your payroll data available to one of these external servers. So I think outsourcing definitely played a part in this attack.
Names, addresses, dates of birth and social security numbers have all been leaked. The BBC says personal banking details are not included in the hack. I got in touch with a number of journalists at the broadcaster. I used to work there for several years, but no one wants to speak on the record. They're not authorised to do so, and they say it might jeopardise their jobs. But several people tell me they are worried. Two journalists who've been hacked say they're concerned their families might be targeted. Both of them report on Russia and the war in Ukraine. Rob McLeod, the cybersecurity expert, says he's not sure the hackers will have much interest in that.
What's more common is for the ransomware operators to actually go into the data. For example, if healthcare data is compromised, what they'll actually do is go into the patient records and actually threaten to divulge personal information, personal health records.
There's a reason McLeod is talking about health data.
At this point, the province says current and former employees of Nova Scotia Health, the IWK Health Centre and the public service were affected by the security breach.
More than 100,000 people in Nova Scotia have also had their personal details stolen in the same hack. McLeod points out that's about 10% of the province's entire population. The Nova Scotia government says a specific ransom has not been demanded as of yet. But this week, the hackers put out a statement on the internet saying companies had 1 week to start negotiating. Rob McLeod says around half of the companies who get hacked end up paying some kind of ransom. That doesn't mean that the data will not be leaked, though. Rafe Pilling, who's based in Edinburgh, is the director for threat research at SecureWorks, a cybersecurity company.
Potentially some organisations pay and their data will not be leaked, although there's, you know, you're dealing with a criminal group, there's no guarantees.
Pilling says hacking has become an unfortunate fact of life and that the public just needs to be vigilant.
They should be suspicious of approaches that they receive, particularly anything that is maybe financial and anything that is sort of trying to cultivate a sense of urgency or sort of maybe freezing your credit and engaging in credit monitoring services. But yeah, it's difficult.
Michelle Stanistreet with the National Union of Journalists says the British government should be issuing some advice too.
The BBC is our public service broadcaster. I mean, I think when you're at that stage of, you know, British institutions being blackmailed in such a way, then that absolutely is something that the government has to take on.
I asked the BBC for a comment about all this, saying as a former employee, I know that journalists there are worried, but they just send an email saying no one is available to speak with me.
One more update on this story. Orla Barry's on the line with me now. Orla, I understand you got another email from the BBC last night. What was that about?
I did, Carol, but it wasn't the BBC press office this time around. It was the payroll department who were telling me that my own personal details have been included in this data breach. In other words, I've been hacked.
Oh, dear. Now, as we heard from one of the experts you spoke with, this is unfortunately a fact of life these days. What do you do? I mean, what's next?
Well, the BBC guidance is to notify a credit reporting agency, someone like Experian, and then simply to keep an eye on my bank accounts. Other than that, there doesn't seem to be much you can do. I mean, as you say, the cybersecurity experts are warning this isn't going away. In fact, a number of people I spoke with this week think a lot more companies and a lot more individuals are going to be affected by this particular hack, that we really don't know the half of it yet. And it'll take a few months to get a full picture of all the companies that have been targeted, because it's used by a lot of companies, particularly in North America. So all I can do is keep an eagle eye on my bank account and, I guess, not respond to any suspicious text messages or emails that I get.
Take care there. Orla Barry is the world's Europe correspondent. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
Recently, we reported on the sewage drifting up from Tijuana, Mexico, and how it shut down the beach in the closest California town to the Mexican border, Imperial Beach, as Mayor Paloma Aguirre told me recently.
I honestly believe this is one of the most severe and egregious environmental injustices in the nation.
Now the mayor has taken her cause to the White House, as San Diego's Channel 7 News explained.
She's calling for the administration to issue a state of emergency similar to the federal response you'd see after a hurricane, allowing for urgency, coordination, and funding and resources.
Funds that will assist in a cross-border collaboration to better deal with the pollution. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. 75 miles, 5 days. That's how long the journey is from Sonora, Mexico to Tucson, Arizona on foot. That is, if the people walking can find water and have enough food for the journey across the vast desert. This is the trek that many migrants coming to the U.S. make. This week, people taking part in the 20th annual Migrant Trail Walk followed in their footsteps. Danielle Camara with Arizona Public Media met up with a group of walkers as they arrived back in Tucson.
Silverio Ontiveros carries a white cross that reads, Guru Preet Kaur. The 6-year-old girl died while crossing the U.S.-Mexico border with her mother in 2019. A CNN story says that she and her mother had traveled from India to reunite with her father in New York. While trekking in more than 100-degree weather through the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge with another woman and child, they ran out of water.
Guru Preet's mother decided to go look for water and left her daughter with the other woman and her child. And when she came back, she couldn't find them.
Border Patrol found the girl's body in the desert the next day. The medical examiner said the cause of death was exposure and probably hyperthermia. 60 participants began the 75-mile migrant trail walk on Memorial Day in Sasebe, Sonora. The intention of the walk is to call for an end to migrant deaths along the U.S.-Mexico border. As the walk has grown over the years, it has drawn participants from throughout the U.S., as well as Latin America, Canada, and Europe. Ontiveros has been doing the walk for about 7 years. He got involved in part because of his connection to migrants in his community during his 33 years as a police officer in Phoenix, and also because his father was an immigrant from Mexico.
Many of my friends right now are undocumented, and you know, we're just praying that one day the government will modernize our immigration policies and allow them to be eventually citizens.
When Kat Rodriguez helped organize the first walk 20 years ago with a few people from the advocacy group Border Links, they decided to only do it a second year if they agreed to walk until the deaths stopped.
I can tell you, at my 27 years of age, I did not think we would be walking 20 years. We just thought people would figure it out. People would understand, like, thousands and thousands of people are dying right here in our border community. And we thought something will change, right?
People have recovered nearly 4,000 sets of human remains in Arizona's U.S.-Mexico border since the year 2000. Most of them died from exposure to the elements. When the small group started the walk 20 years ago, they had one cell phone, but didn't have service for a week. For water, they would drive into the Aravaca fire station, fill up containers, and shove $10 under the door. Now walkers have a medical team, regular water refills, and volunteers making them food. For these reasons and more, Rodriguez says the walk is not meant to simulate the migrant experience, but to try and get the word out in hopes it will impact people's hearts and minds.
I guess I have less faith in policy and elected officials and politics than I do in people. And the people walking, I trust them, they're going to go home and talk about the border. And eventually I hope it'll make a difference.
Saulo Padilla has been doing the walk for 13 years after hearing about it where he works doing migration education at the Mennonite Central Committee in Goshen, Indiana, a sponsor of the walk. From Guatemala, when Padilla was a child, his father became a political refugee after he was tortured and pushed out of their home country. Padilla crossed the Guatemala-Mexico border with his mother and 4 siblings to reunite with his father. The family eventually migrated to Canada when Padilla was 15.
40 years ago, I was one of these children crossing the border with my mom, looking for my dad in Mexico. So yes, this connects directly to my own personal experience of migrating, and I truly believe that people should have the right to migrate when they're in danger, when they're in poverty, when they're hungry, when they're looking for a better future or education for their children.
Participants finished the migrant trail walk after a week of walking. For The World, I'm Danielle Camara.
This next story is completely nuts. That's because we're talking cashews. The world's leading producer of cashews is the West African nation of Ivory Coast. It's a big part of the economy, but the industry there is being hammered by a drop in the global demand for the nut. Marcel Ouattara is the executive secretary of the Ivory Coast Cashew Industry Group. He joins us from the country's largest city, Abidjan. Marcel, start by telling us just how important cashews are for the economy of the Ivory Coast.
Thank you, Carol, for the invitation. Ivory Coast economy rely really on the agricultural product, and the cashew sector is about 1.1 million tons produced in 2022. So cashew is a very big, important sector in Côte d'Ivoire.
So it employs a lot of people too, doesn't it?
Yes, a lot of people working there. We have, let's say, 80% of women working into this industry.
Did you say that 80% of the workers are women?
Yes.
That's interesting. What does the work involve?
They have to work on to remove the parts out of the kernel. So they are working into the processing plant.
And cashews in Ivory Coast, it's largely an export product as opposed to domestic consumption.
Yes, at this moment it's largely an export product. The local consumption is really small.
What has caused the current global slump in demand for cashews, which is affecting Ivory Coast?
We think we have two factors. On the first side, for us, the first factor is a decrease in demand because of the world economic situation, the war in Ukraine, and some financial crisis in developed countries. And we have also the production at a normal level as expected from Côte d'Ivoire and West Africa.
So you've got issues like the war in Ukraine, you've got inflation, and competitor markets like Vietnam that are reducing the demand for the cashews of the Ivory Coast?
Yes, I would say so.
So at this point, is Ivory Coast experiencing a phenomenon where you have a whole lot of cashews and not enough buyers for them?
Yes, we are currently experiencing it, but the government is working on it. They are communicating with the different actors into the value chain. They are communicating with the processors. They are communicating with the producers. They are supporting them onto the marketing side to ensure that they are able to sell their product.
What do you need to happen then to get cashew production and cashew sales from Ivory Coast back up to where you want them? What do you need as an industry person?
We need support for investments, support on new technology to be used, also communication, marketing and commercial support from the purchaser into the United States and also from the government. I think that's mainly what we need, and also foreign direct investment into the sector.
I eat a lot of cashews. I really love them. Are the cashews I'm eating here in the U.S., are they from Ivory Coast?
Some of them, I think. I don't have full details, but some of the cashew used and consumed into the United States are from Côte d'Ivoire.
Marcel, do you like cashews?
Yes. I eat it every week.
Salted or plain?
Salted.
Me too. Marcel Ouattara is executive secretary of the Ivory Coast Cashew Industry Group, which represents 20 companies that process the nut. Thanks for speaking with us, Marcel.
Thank you, Carol.
You're listening to The World. El Nino has arrived again. West Coasters know the deal. With climate change, expect a rough ride.
So we might get both crazy local weather in lots of individual places and globally one of the warmest years on record.
Plus, the French Open wraps up this weekend. We've got the clay courts covered ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The war in Sudan has taken another worrying turn. The government says that the UN envoy to the country, a key mediator in the conflict, is no longer welcome there. The Sudanese government accuses Volker Perthes of being partisan. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia were, however, able to broker a 24-hour ceasefire that starts tomorrow. It will be the 8th ceasefire since fighting began in mid-April. The first 7 have quickly fallen apart. Sudan's military has been locked in a brutal fight with a rival paramilitary group. The conflict has spread to the long-suffering western region of Darfur and has reduced the capital, Khartoum, to an urban battlefield. In videos posted on Twitter, rebels patrol the streets in trucks outfitted with heavy machine guns in their pickup beds. Both sides take videos of themselves fighting. This one is from inside an armored vehicle. A sweaty-faced commander picks targets and barks orders to a gunner. In the past 2 days, the fighting has centered on a place called Yarmouk Compound. It's a weapons factory. It looked like the paramilitary had taken control. Then government tanks rolled in, with some civilians watching, filming and cheering. Then the next day, rebels appear to have recaptured the factory. A rebel soldier walks through the cache of arms, pointing to all the guns and ammunition they now control. Later, the government claimed it had captured the factory back. A snapshot of the recent fighting in Khartoum. Attacks and retreats. Elsewhere in Sudan, ethnic clashes broke out yesterday inside a UN site. More than 20 people were killed and at least 50 wounded. Since the fighting began, more than 800 civilians have been killed and about 1.4 million people have been displaced. The decades of war in Darfur and Sudan have been well chronicled. Filmmaker Mohamed Kordofani recently brought one chapter of Sudan's violent history to the big screen. He became the first Sudanese filmmaker to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival last month. As the world's Halima Gikandi reports, the moment was bittersweet.
The film, called Goodbye, Julia, is set during a pivotal time in Sudan's history, in the mid-2000s, right after a deadly civil war between the North and the South. These are the years that 39-year-old filmmaker Mohamed Kordofani wanted to go back to in his first feature film.
We were some of the lucky or unlucky ones to witness this, so I felt the responsibility to document this period of time for generations to come.
This film centers on the relationship between two women from different ethnic, religious, and class backgrounds. There's Monna, a Muslim from the north of Sudan, and Julia, a Christian from the south.
It's following a story of two women, one from each side, who come together in extraordinary circumstances.
Those extraordinary circumstances include an accident that leads to the death of Julia's husband. Monna tries to make amends by taking Julia in as her housekeeper, along with her young son. The two develop a close relationship against the backdrop of ethnic and religious tensions in Sudan. In one scene, there are demonstrations of black South Sudanese outside of Mona's house. Her husband, Akram, who's lighter-skinned, says disparagingly, "Look at those slaves." This is the kind of prejudice that filmmaker Kordofani addresses head-on, because he admits he once had them too.
And I think racism and classism is part of that heritage that we've received from generations before us. I found that journey that I took very interesting, and I wanted to explore it in a creative way.
Kordofani hopes his film, Goodbye, Julia, gives Sudanese an opening to talk about things like racism, classism, sexism, things that are still very controversial in Sudan.
You're touching on a very sensitive topic, a taboo almost, so people are not usually comfortable addressing these things.
But controversy isn't bad, he says, especially if it leads to dialogue. Getting this film made in and of itself was a huge feat. While Sudan's film industry is growing, the constant political insecurity has made film production difficult, Kordofani tells me. For example, he started shooting Goodbye, Julia in November 2022, following a military coup in Sudan that prompted nationwide pro-democracy protests.
We would experience tear gas on set and a lot of blocked roads, so we cannot move from one location to another. And more times than not, we would have to change the shooting location just because we cannot get there.
The effort has paid off. Last month, Goodbye, Julia won the Freedom Prize at the Cannes Film Festival.
This is an award that celebrates our freedom to express and freedom to live in a world that is free of racism and free of prejudice.
Kordofani says this recognition is particularly meaningful with the conflict in Sudan right now.
At the time of this interview, our homes, our neighborhoods, our country is hijacked by militias and by military.
This was good news amid all the agony, he says. The ongoing fighting in Sudan between the country's military and paramilitary forces has caused widespread destruction and displacement. Kordofani tells me he recently saw a photo on social media of a destroyed market he had filmed in.
When I saw that picture, I felt really bad. I felt really sad for what happened to Khartoum and to Sudan in general. But I also felt a little bit of joy because I was able to take a snapshot of Khartoum just before the war and a portrait that I think we will get to cherish when the war stops.
In the meantime, Mohamed Kordofani is focused on promoting his new film, Goodbye, Julia, and hopes it will premiere in North America in the coming year. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
The world's top tennis players have been lighting up the clay courts at the French Open for the past 2 weeks. The singles competitions come to a head this weekend. The world's Bianca Hillier has been following the action and updates us on what's been going on at Roland Garros.
Right down the line from Muhova. 30 love.
Czech tennis pro Karolina Muhova looked like she was going to walk away with the semifinal win in the second set of yesterday's match. But her opponent, world number two Aryna Sabalenka, said not so fast.
Big serve by Sabalenka, who's now taken a bit of the control in this tiebreak.
The pair ended up going back and forth in an all-court three-hour-long battle, with unseeded Muhova coming out on top. This was a major loss for Sabalenka, but an even bigger win for Muhova. She punched her ticket to her first ever Grand Slam final. Still, in the on-court interview, she said she's trying to stay grounded.
I don't want to get into my head, you know, too much to become cocky or anything. I'm just trying to play my game, and I'm glad it worked so well. I thank to my team and everyone. We work on this together, so it's our success.
Tomorrow, the 26-year-old will face 22-year-old Iga Świątek.
Hopes alive for a third French Open title and a fourth major title for Iga Świątek.
The Polish pro is ranked number one in the world and was largely expected to advance to the finals, but Brazil's Beatriz Haddad-Maia forced a second-set tiebreak and gave Świątek a stunning run for her money. Haddad-Maia is the first Brazilian woman to reach a major semifinal since 1968. And even after the loss, fans back home are beaming with pride.
Oh, I'm crazy happy. I'm crazy happy. It was beautiful. It was incredible.
Martin Diller covers Brazilian tennis players from Rio de Janeiro. He says this tournament cemented Haddad-Maia as a Brazilian tennis idol, and it seemed like more people around the country were watching tennis than ever before.
I can't put in words how big it was for her, for our tennis, for our fans, for the players that are growing up right now.
And earlier today, at the men's semifinal matches, it was hot and windy in Paris when Novak Djokovic and Carlos Alcaraz took the court in what was previewed as a generational battle. 36-year-old Djokovic is a tennis legend and 22-time Grand Slam champion, whereas 20-year-old Alcaraz won his first Grand Slam title just last year, but is the top-ranked player in the world right now and is widely regarded as the sport's next major star. The match didn't disappoint. In the second set, Alcaraz made the shot of the tournament by sprinting from the net to the baseline just in time to hit the ball back over the net and win the point. It defied physics, and even Djokovic applauded the move. In the end, though, it wasn't enough to advance.
I think his arms were even cramping.
His whole body seems to be breaking down.
Momentum drastically shifted after Alcaraz suffered from cramping in the third set, sending Djokovic into the finals. There, he'll face Casper Ruud. The Norwegian beat Germany's Alexander Zverev in this afternoon's semifinal match. World number 5, Stefanos Tsitsipas, had hoped to be among the finalists in Paris, but he lost in the quarterfinals against Alcaraz. And in a press conference, Tsitsipas says he already knows what he'll steer clear of in the next tournament.
One thing that I'm going to try and avoid in the future is melatonin pills and naps before matches, because it clearly doesn't seem to be working.
The Greek pro said he took melatonin and naps this time around because late-night matches ruined his sleeping schedule. Some people on social media said, stars, they're just like us, while others gave him a bit of flack for the rookie mistake. But the French Tennis Federation made a major effort this year to combat online hate. They gave each athlete the option to download an app that uses AI to block death threats and other negative comments.
Yeah, it's a great idea and a step forward to the right direction.
Świątek is one of the players who opted into the social media fix.
Because honestly, it's just sad to kind of see that the thing that was supposed to make us happy and make us socialize is giving us more negative feelings and negative thoughts.
Świątek will be channeling only positive thoughts tomorrow when she faces Muchova at 9 a.m. Eastern time. The men's final is at the same time on Sunday. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
One of the biggest music festivals in Europe recently wrapped up in Barcelona. It's called Primavera Sound. More than 100 artists performed for some 250,000 people. Depeche Mode, Calvin Harris, the Pet Shop Boys, and of course local pop star Rosalia were among the headliners. This weekend, the entire festival shifts over to Madrid. Then Primavera heads to Portugal, then South America. From Barcelona, Alan Ruiz Terol reports on what's driving the global expansion of these massive concerts.
For those who've never been to a music festival, imagine an amusement park with stages instead of attractions, and bars and food trucks, and music coming from everywhere, and people with amazing outfits. It's Gemma Corr-Brown's first time at a festival. She's traveled all the way from the UK for Primavera Sound.
It's honestly unlike anything I've really tried before, but yeah, it's nice to see everyone out of their comfort zone and just like really relaxing and vibing to the music.
She is with friends from work. Julie Olejnik was the one who had the idea of coming to the festival.
It's just my favorite festival. It's like, I can't explain that. It's just the vibe around here and... Yeah, I guess like when you said to me, come to Primavera Sound, I didn't even ask about the lineup. The thing that you said to me was like, oh, it's on the seafront, the vibe is amazing, like the people here are really cool. Like
Barcelona is one of the biggest tourist destinations in the world, which helps explain why more than half of all attendees are foreigners. With more and more people wanting to come, Primavera grew larger, says festival organizer Joan Pons.
Els soldats fan molta il·lusió fins que veus que hi ha 10.000, 15.000 persones que s'estan cagant amb tu perquè no han aconseguit aquella entrada.
Selling out is nice, he says, until you realize that 10 or 15,000 people are mad at you because they didn't get any tickets. Managing growth can be difficult. Last year, the festival came back from the pandemic hiatus in full force with a double edition in Barcelona. 500,000 people attended, and many complained of huge crowds and long lines. After disagreements with local authorities in Barcelona, the festival moved its second weekend to Madrid this year. In springtime in South America, Primavera is also holding back-to-back festivals in Sao Paulo, Buenos Aires, Bogotá and Asunción. Additional locations and dates make festivals more competitive when hiring artists.
Si le ofereixes només un concert a una zona geográfica, és molt complicat per ells que els hi pugui sortir a compte. Per tot el que això suposa doncs, de despeses, de traslladar doncs, el seu show a una ciutat o a una altra. No?
If you're offering an artist just one show, it may be not worth it for them, says Pons. Three gigs in a week, though, is more persuasive and may help you land big names like Halsey, Blur or Kendrick Lamar. Scaling up is a well-established trend among festivals. Coachella has been holding double editions for years. And Lollapalooza, which started in Chicago, now has 6 franchises in Europe and Latin America. This helps build a brand and get good sponsors and investors, which bring economic stability to the risky business of festivals. At Primavera, company logos are everywhere. Each stage is named after a sponsor, be it a bank, a beer label, or a car maker. But even with large sums coming in, festivals are becoming more expensive, even prohibitive. Carlos Chirinos, a professor at New York University, says this is part of a bigger story about the whole music industry and how it lost its main revenue source, physical record sales, because of the internet.
The public does not give that much importance to recorded music anymore because it's easy access. And that's basic economic theory, right? If it's something it's easy to access, you are not prepared or ready to pay for it.
But people still crave the experience of live music, especially after the pandemic.
Increasingly, the artists are seeing festivals and the live scene as the time to tell their narrative, where they connect with audiences and where they also generate this critical revenue.
Consequently, festivals are setting the stage for ever more spectacular live shows. Last weekend at Primavera, Catalan artist Rosalía was the final headlining act. She played piano, danced on high heels, rode a scooter on stage, and even joined the crowd to let fans sing along. For The World, I'm Alan Ruiz Terol, Barcelona.
If you've ever experienced an El Niño season, you know it's no picnic. West Coast listeners, buckle up for a wet ride. The weather pattern centered in the Pacific Ocean occurs every 2 to 7 years. A new one has just arrived, and scientists are worried that climate change could make this one even worse. Chris Callahan studies El Niño and its impacts. He's a climate scientist at Dartmouth College and joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. So, Chris, in a nutshell, what is El Niño?
El Niño is a recurring pattern of ocean temperatures in the Pacific Ocean. An El Niño event is when you get really warm waters in the eastern Pacific near Peru or Ecuador. So you get extreme rainfall on that side of the Pacific and drought in places like Australia and Indonesia and really wild weather patterns around the world.
Are El Niños inevitable? I mean, do they always occur or did they kind of start occurring a while ago and now keep going?
El Niños happen with or without humans and have occurred for thousands or millions of years. They are a naturally occurring oscillation in ocean temperatures. But now that humans have started changing the climate, we are becoming aware of the interactions and potentially dangerous synergies between climate change and these naturally occurring patterns.
And what are the human elements that have changed El Niño or its impact?
Well, the El Niño years are also typically very hot years. We know that 2016 was the hottest year on record, partly because of climate change, but partly because there was also a major El Niño that year. And so some of the craziest weather that we've seen and some of the warmest temperatures occur when human-caused climate change and El Niño kind of stack on top of each other. And that's what we can expect to see going forward this year and next year as well.
You've alluded to this, but I want to press further. Most of the warmest years on record have occurred during El Niños. How concerned are scientists about this latest one that's just arrived?
Absolutely, very concerned. There is a very high chance that one of the next few years will be the hottest year on record, surpassing 2016. And there's a good chance that that could be this year or next year, because El Niño just pumps an immense amount of energy into the atmosphere from the tropical ocean. And so it can really raise temperatures globally and reorganize global weather. So we might get both crazy local weather in lots of individual places and globally one of the warmest years on record.
I want to get a little nerdy here and ask you what elements that humans have contributed to climate change, how do they then interact with El Niño?
Yeah, there is a lot of research that has tried to figure out how climate change might actually be changing El Niño itself. We have some sense that As climate change accelerates, we might see changes in the local tropical Pacific that might make El Niños more intense and potentially more frequent. And so you get basically amplification of some of the feedback processes in the Pacific Ocean, which is what really drive El Niño. And so our climate models tell us that as warmer temperatures continue to rise in the future, El Niños could become more intense.
How long could this El Niño last?
Typically, El Niños begin to develop in the summer and fall. They peak in the winter, and then they decay in the following spring. So we should expect to see this El Niño developing over the rest of this calendar year, peaking and then decaying in the first half of 2024.
Now, speaking of how long this is going to last, research published last month that you co-authored found that the average El Niño costs the global economy more than $3 trillion. That's trillion with a T. Explain that.
Yeah, our research looked at El Niño as a physical phenomenon, but then connected it to the economic impacts of this type of climate variability. And we found that El Niño events, because they drive this extreme weather in places like the tropics, they can produce substantial economic losses due to, for example, extreme weather events like extreme rainfall. And so these economic effects persist actually for several years after the event itself has ended. So you can see depressed economic growth for years following an El Niño event, and countries are not able to recover from these major extreme weather events. And so we are getting a sense that they are extremely costly.
Are we talking just destruction, or is it more nuanced than that?
It's both destruction and something more than that. So there's definitely the sort of immediate destruction of infrastructure, crops, for example, in the year of an El Niño. But we also found that there is this sort of longer term depression of economic growth, the sort of break on your economy over 5 or 10 years following the event, as, for example, investment has to be reallocated towards recovery rather than productive technology development or things like that. And so you also get this sort of more subtle and more persistent depression in economic output for years.
Is it true that countries affected by El Niño are still paying for previous El Niños?
We think so, yes. Because these events have effects that last for many years, it's possible that countries are still seeing the sort of legacies of, for example, the 2016 event even today.
We've been speaking to Chris Callahan. He's a climate scientist at Dartmouth College, and he's been speaking to us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we've got El Niño, and we're also seeing a troubling phenomenon that will likely be even more severe next year. That's the wildfires raging across Canada. In the past, Canadian firefighters have traveled abroad when other countries needed urgent additional support. Now Canada is on the receiving end of that global help. A large team from South Africa was dispatched to the Canadian province of Alberta earlier this week, as reported by the SABC news outlet in South Africa.
Experienced firefighting teams, coupled with expertise in complex fire situation, they are mentally and physically fit.
And by the way, those South African firefighters have some other talents. When they landed at the Edmonton airport this week, they actually burst into song. South Africans are being joined by American firefighters to battle blazes in Canada. It's an international effort. As for the singing, when South African firefighters flew to Canada back in 2016, they also busted out their vocal chops on their airport arrival. And it doesn't end at the baggage carousel for those men and women. In South Africa, singing while going into battle against fires is part of their training. In fact, global firefighters who attended an international wildfire conference in South Africa in 2011 were greeted by at least 300 South African firefighters in song. This kind of spontaneous singing springs out of the Toi Toi tradition in South Africa. Decades ago, chanting and dancing would erupt during political protests against apartheid. These wildfires in Canada and elsewhere in the world are just another battle we're all facing. We leave you today with the voices of South African firefighters who arrived north of the border in Canada this week. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're online at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a relaxing weekend. Thanks for listening.